Aging is real, and so are the benefits of adding vital proteins, collagen, peptides to your daily routine. Because around the age of 30, your body needs backup to keep your collagen up to help support healthy hair, skin, nails, bones, and joints. Available in the classic collagen peptides, collagen and protein shakes, and new Vital Proteins collagen sparkling waters, so you can stay vital, stay you. Visit vitalproteins.com to learn more and where to buy.
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is Sarah Spain from Good Game with Sarah Spain, brought to you in part by Vital Farms. Let me tell you why Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs are the only eggs I have in my fridge. The hens. They're living the good life. Fresh air, sunshine, and wide open pastures. I use my Vital Farms for my famous frittatas. And you could trace your eggs back to the farm they came from. Check the carton for the farm name, pop it into vitalfarms.com/farm, and boom, you're looking at the pasture. So next time you're in the store, look for the black carton in the egg aisle and visit vitalfarms.com to learn more. Vital Farms, good eggs, no shortcuts.
Hello and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. A little update on the week. We are in Minneapolis, four live shows Wednesday and Thursday. Excited to get out there. There's maybe about a dozen tickets left for Wednesday. So if you have a last second fancy to get up to Minneapolis, buy those ASAP. As far as the pod schedule is concerned, we'll have normal Bulwark Pod like 4 out of the 5 days this week. I think Thursday we will give you guys the Wednesday night show on this feed. And then Friday we'll give you the TNL, the next level show from the Thursday night live show, if that makes sense. So no next level this week until Friday. And besides that, you're on your normal schedule. Speaking of normal schedule, it's Monday. So we got Bill Kristol. Apparently it's President's Day. I did not realize it was President's Day until I started reading your newsletter this morning. Down here, it's just Lundi Gras. But happy President's Day to those who celebrate. You had a little meditation on it this morning, Bill. Do you have any deep thoughts on honoring our presidents?
Happy Lundi Gras. I guess I just had a simple-minded view that there was Mardi Gras, which I was intelligent enough to know, I guess, is a Tuesday. That's why it's Mardi, but I didn't really.
Lundi Gras.
You guys in New Orleans are good at extending these holidays into many days, weeks, months. You know,
it's a whole carnival season, actually. But yeah.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. My meditation was very simple. I mean, when I was young and conservative, it was sort of fashionable to lament the decline of Washington's birthday and for that matter Lincoln's into this generic President's Day, kind of a side of, you know, like all presidents are equal, all presidents are worth admiring. Yeah,
everyone gets a trophy.
That was a very staple of conservative talking points. I may have even published an article to like this in the Weekly Standard. I can't remember. So I'm just being contrarian and saying, well, maybe it's okay that it's become President's Day. I don't think that criticism is totally wrong. It's a little ridiculous. On the other hand, to the degree it reminds us that we've had a lot of bad presidents, a lot of mediocre ones, some bad ones, one or two very bad ones, like our current one. And we shouldn't idolize them. We shouldn't, you know, go out of our way to put them on pedestals. We should just be matter of fact about them and sort of hard-headed citizens of a republic, somewhat skeptical of our leaders. That's a good thing. So that's my contrarian defense of President's Day.
All right. Doesn't really seem like something to take a day off of work for, but being reminded that our presidents are mediocre. They're men only so far.
Yeah. Congress passed this bill in 68 that turned a lot of the holidays into the Monday holidays we're now familiar with. I guess before then, I guess we celebrated all these days on the day.
Right. You know what I mean? So you might have like a Thursday or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. But we're May 30th, whatever day it was, you had off, you know, February 22nd, Washington's birthday, you had off, you know, the Monday thing is obviously convenience in many ways, and it's fine. I'm not objecting to it.
Well, I do appreciate
it. I would have objected to it. 30 years ago, I would have had a big moralistic rant, a patriotic rant about it. And I'm surprised Rubio didn't go out about it, actually, at the conference in Munich. It's another sign of American decline. But now I'm okay with having three-day weekends.
The whole episode might basically be on Marco, so we're going to get to him in a second. He's in Munich over the weekend. But beforehand, as you mentioned, we do like to extend the holidays here in New Orleans. So I was out and about this weekend, and I wasn't, you know, as in tune to the news as I usually am. And so this morning as I was prepping, I was like, let me read the morning newsletters, make sure I didn't miss anything. And I opened Playbook, Politico Playbook, which I rarely do because it has deteriorated and enshittified to a great degree. I mean, it's horrible and hackish, as you're about to find out. But I was reading it and it sparked a thought. They were going through kind of the Trump's laments at the top, like the fact that like this latest you know, spat for him has not been as good based on their figure skating judging as the first two segments of the presidency. But then they give kind of the counter view, you know, like the view from the other side. And that is framed as chin up, Don. And I want to read that for you. Chin up, Don. Beyond the noisy and erratic policy swings, there's plenty out there for the White House to feel good about ahead of the midterms. Tariffs largely haven't created unbearable levels of pain. Trump's pick to lead the Federal Reserve has been well received. The border clampdown is producing results. Crime rates appear to be down. The high-risk strikes on Iran and Venezuela haven't backfired. So in summation, the Iran and Venezuela adventures haven't backfired, and the tariffs have not been totally catastrophic. And that is the morning newsletter from Politico's spin for how great things are going for Trump. What do you make of that?
Did they put in that the Dow Jones is at 50,000? That's a major Trumpist.
It is
a major Trumpist talking point, yeah. I believe. It's why we're not supposed to care about any violations of civil liberties or, you know, killing protesters and so forth. I don't know. Doesn't it cut the other way, Tim? I mean, things look okay in the economy. We're not in a disastrous foreign war. And even so, Trump's approval is down from, what, 50 to 41. Isn't that kind of a bad sign? What if things get a little worse in the economy? Or what if one of the foreign policy misadventures has more immediate real-world consequences? So I would say it's actually a tribute to the American public and cuts against Democratic consultant orthodoxy that people are just focused, you know, Bill, on the kitchen table. You know, it's just the price of everything. And in fact, it turns out public is dissatisfied with Trump for maybe deeper reasons having to do with rights and liberties and dignity and democracy. And that's to the public's credit. But anyway, I don't see why, if I were in the Trump White House, I'd be like, geez, you know, things aren't so terrible as Politico is claiming. And we're still down from 50 to 41.
Yeah. I also just think in general, like if one of your proof points of how things are going well is that something that you did not cause, quote, unbearable levels of pain. It's only caused some modest pain, some light pain. You know, nothing's been achieved from the tariffs. It hasn't caused any successes. There's no evidence that we're reshoring manufacturing. The opposite, as a matter of fact. But, you know, the good news is it didn't cause unbearable levels of pain. I will say one of my notes from walking around, you know, being among the Volk with Mardi Gras, I'm like hearing from people, which I like to hear from people who come up to me. The mood of the average resistor is better now. Which I think speaks to his political pain. And I think that there are a lot of folks that came out to me, you know, maybe last Mardi Gras would have been like dire. I mean, depressed. Should I move? You know, it was a popular question that I was getting this time last year. Like, should I flee the country? Now, on the streets, I was getting a lot of, it feels like it might be over for him. I had to tamp a couple people down. It's like a lot of work ahead. But I do think that the sense of his political standing is pretty rough at the moment. All right, to Marco. I don't even know how to frame this up. He was in Munich giving some grand remarks at a security conference and hopped over to our only European friend in Budapest and did a little joint press conference with Viktor Orban. I want to play some clips from all of that for us to react to. This was the first one that caught my eye. It was Marco on how to think about the nature of war and how America thinks about the nature of war now. Let's listen to that.
Because armies do not fight for abstractions. Armies fight for a people. Armies fight for a nation. Armies fight for a way of life. And that is what we are defending.
This is Marco's pivot from neoconservative into nationalist blood and soil diplomat who just only cares about the material interests of our people. The problem is that I don't believe that anything that he said there was actually right when it comes to the nature of war. But why don't you go on that and then I'll kind of expand on my thoughts.
I was appalled by it on many levels. And I mean, first of all, there was this thing called the Civil War, kind of a big war in America. I believe, did we have more casualties in the Civil War than maybe World War II? But anyway, certainly as a percentage of the population, many, many more. A hell of a lot of people fought in the Civil War. They weren't fighting for one nation. There was no question we were a nation. We had a common culture, if that's what you care about. As Lincoln famously said, but didn't he say this in the second inaugural? We read the same Bible and prayed to the same God, you know? So very common culture-ish. And we fought because of principle, because of an abstraction, because all men are created equal, as Lincoln explained. And as the Southerners, to be fair, understood perfectly well as well. I mean, they were also fighting for their way of life. I guess slavery was a key part of it, but it was based on an abstract view of human equality or human inequality.
Yeah.
So it's just silly. And incidentally, World War II, which I think that's still an okay war by Marco's standards, though I don't know, not by the Trumpists, I guess. We were attacked on Pearl Harbor, so we fought of course, in Japan. But the war again in Europe, I mean, Hitler declared war on us, which gave Roosevelt an excuse, frankly, to go to war against him. But that war in Europe, we weren't attacked by Nazi Germany much. I mean, some shipping was attacked, and we could have stayed out of that. And we did stay out of it, incidentally, for 2 years. And what was the justification for the many, many people who died helping liberate Europe? Because it was freedom. You know, what did Eisenhower called it, the Great Crusade? I mean, anyway, it's not even worth going on. It's so obvious. But yeah, so it's just not true what Marco's saying. And it just diminishes American history, any sense of actual American greatness, of what America means. And final point, since this is more like back to my political theory days, what is America? What are we based on? We're based on an abstraction. All men are created equal. Does Marco reread any of those sentences in the Declaration of Independence?
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, they're kind of abstract, you know, and they are literally at the foundation of our nation. Lincoln famously praised Jefferson in 1859 for inserting in what he called a merely revolutionary document an abstract truth that would be a stumbling block to tyrants at all times, something like that, a beautiful letter he wrote in 1859 in praise of Jefferson. And so, I mean, again, Rubio in his slightly gentler than J.D. Vance way, in his somewhat clever way, I guess you'd say, is just dressing up the same nationalist nonsense.
All right, quick quiz for the hiring managers out there. What's worse, being understaffed or being poorly staffed? Well, that's a trick question, because both are recipes for chaos. Either way, just say to yourself, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. You'll get matched with candidates that meet the skills, certifications, and everything else you're looking for. Or go a different way and get no traction. Seriously, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. It really is a no-brainer. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs.
Struggling to see up close? Make it visible with Viz. Viz is a once daily prescription eye drop to treat blurry near vision for up to 10 hours. The most common side effects that may be experienced while using Viz include eye irritation, temporary dim or dark vision, headaches, and eye redness. Talk to an eye doctor to learn if Viz is right for you. Learn more at Viz.com.
I am going to go on, even though it's obvious, just because that's our want. You were right, just by the way, that the Civil War, there were more deaths in the Civil War than World War II. I guess I'll just avoid the kind of college dorm room element of the conversation, which is that, I mean, are nations and peoples also kind of abstractions, like in some sense? I think maybe they are, but we'll set that aside. The motivation for war, the noble motivation for many wars in the past have been about abstractions, not about, people's economic concerns, or not necessarily about just, the actual tribe with which you are from. I mean, the Crusades, the Protestants versus the Catholics, all of the wars, all of the efforts against the communists. Like, it's just not true. Like, what Marco just said is not true in any sense of the world. A lot of the pernicious wars, by the way, were about abstractions, like fake abstractions, imaginary, trying to turn, another peoples into less than human, right, or subhuman because of, various abstractions about religion or ideology or otherwise. So why it rankles me so much is because he's doing it in service of creating a new idea of what America is, right? Like, that's the whole point of this, right? It's redefining America. And it's redefining America's goals and objectives and history, and it's trying to turn us into a country that is only united based on, I guess, some Anglo-Saxon heritage and the fact that we grew up on the same land. And like, that is not what America is about. And it's a dangerous view, frankly, of what America is about. And he expands on that a little bit in this next bit, talking about our cultural element that we have in common. And this is when I really start to stroke out. So let's take a listen to this.
It was this continent that produced the genius of Mozart and Beethoven, of Dante and Shakespeare, of Michelangelo and Da Vinci, of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And this is the place where the vaulted ceilings of the Sistine Chapel and the towering spires of the great cathedral in Cologne, they testify not just to the greatness of our past or to a faith in God that inspired these marvels. They foreshadow the wonders that await us in our future. But only if we are unapologetic in our heritage and proud of this common inheritance can we together begin the work of envisioning and shaping our economic and our political future.
Unapologetic about our common heritage. I do feel like I have to point out that Marco is from fucking Cuba, not Europe. And that the music and art of Cuba and of Latin America is different than that of Europe. And obviously, there is a common ancestry in a lot of cases because, you know, Portuguese and Spanish came over and colonized Central and South America. But do people in Malaga wax poetic about how they have a common cultural heritage with the people of Copenhagen? Like, he is trying to sand down the edges of the various cultural differences and create a, I hate to finally use this phrase, but like an Anglo-Saxon supremacist view of like what our cultural heritage is. And that the only thing that like unites us to Europe is not like commitment to a rule of law, not common, you know, not common defense and economic trade, but what it is, the fact that we all like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Mozart. And it's like, it's crazy. I mean, like, anybody who's been to fucking Miami where he grows up understands that it's crazy. Like, there is a lot of cultural difference in Miami. Like, there is some similarity. There's some ways in which we overlap, in which we're different from Eastern cultures. Like, that's fine all to explore. But like, this notion that we have to be unapologetic about this and we have to use that to prevent the bad people and the bad cultures from coming to our country or from being a part of it. And that like we have to unite in some right-wing nationalist historic view of our architecture and our music. It is white nationalist agitprop. And he's Cuban. I don't really know any other way to describe what he's doing. He's doing it in Germany, too. Just right out there.
Why did Marco's parents come here? I mean, I believe they came here because they wanted liberty. And they came to the land of the free because they wanted freedom. And so they, not because they thought, you know, I want to become more Anglo-Saxon. I don't believe that was, you know, so you're absolutely right about that.
Their son did decide he likes American football better than, you know, the world's football, maybe to their shame. But besides that, yeah, I don't think that was it either.
Yeah, so there's that side of it, if you will. And I mean, it's really particularly appalling for him to be saying this. And he knew better. He used to give very inspiring speeches about his parents being immigrants and America being the land of opportunity and so forth. And that's why I kind of liked Marco. I guess I was suckered a bit in 2010 and all when he ran for the Senate, but that didn't turn out to go very deep, did it? The other point I'd make is sort of the flip side of the point you're making, but they're both equally true, I think, which is the whole point about Mozart and Michelangelo and all these names he's dropping and all this is they have universal appeal. They are great. They're not great because they're, you know, because Mozart came from Salzburg and then ended up in Vienna. And in fact, if you look at people who enjoy great art and great music and great literature, it's enjoyed the world over. And some of the greatest performers are from Asia and from anywhere. I'm not even going to go out. It's such an obvious point. But so it's precisely the universalism, one might call it the globalism, of these great works of art and literature that makes them so important. And it's great that we host a lot of them now. A lot of them are not from America, as Marco sort of suggests. They're from Europe. And it's great that we feel that they're also part of America now. Of course, we also have our distinctive American stuff, which in fact is very popular in Europe, jazz and so forth. So that's why globalism is better than stupid ethno-nationalism.
Yes.
Right? I mean, honestly. With Marco, he's not quite vulgar enough, or maybe because he's Marco Rubio, he can't quite go in the J.D. Vance hillbilly elegy direction of just flat out Scots-Irish, you know, bullshit, you know, ethno-nationalism. So he has this sort of fancier version of it. If you're just a straight up ethno-nationalist, just okay, just go be a straight up ethno-nationalist. But with Marco, it's such a fake thing and it's put on in this fancy way with so much lipstick on that pig in Marco's speech, you know?
I should also just note that the Rolling Stones in particular, like, stole their music from Black American culture, people that we had enslaved and right. brought over from Africa. So I don't know that there's like a great connection between Mozart and the Rolling Stones or like a direct line on that front. If you're trying to make it that it was all that this could only have been created because of the Western European culture, like, the Rolling Stones music was created because of the way in which we enslaved and oppressed other people, and that, like, yielded some great art. And, like, this whole notion, again, it's like that, you know, that there is something special about this culture that needs to be preserved, and we need to protect it, and we need to be, you know, be thoughtful about how to assimilate people that come from different cultures that don't, you know, have the same respect for these classically liberal theories. For starters, they don't believe in the classical liberal theories. Like, Trump is a straight affront to them. And there have been plenty of people from all these cultures. And, like, to your point from earlier, does the socialism of Central America mean that Central Americans can't come to America and like Marco has to rise to be Secretary of State? He's, again, I should say it one more time, he was in Germany. So, I mean, there's some limits to our culture and its commitment to, you know, these principles and values. And so the whole, like, oh, you don't have to apologize from them. You can't acknowledge what the reality is, that all of this takes work. You know, a respect for the rule of law and a respect for the beautiful and great things that have been created in Western culture, it requires continued work and effort and commitment to those values. And these guys are a straight attack on all of them. Like, they want to do the, like, again, the agitprop about the good elements of the culture without actually, you know, contributing to any of the sacrifice that is required to maintain it. That's my final rant about this.
That's really well said at the point about sacrifice, but also the unapologetic thing also, well, we're just being rankled and venting, but we're venting just
righteously.
No, righteously, I believe. Yes, right, this is righteous venting. The unapologetic thing is appalling. What did he say? We have to be unapologetic in our heritage. No serious person thinks there's nothing to apologize about in our heritage. In the American heritage, I mean, let's not just be too obvious here and talk about slavery and talk about the treatment of Native Americans. Well, let's talk about a million other things. We made a lot of mistakes. And every serious European thinker, including the ones he mentioned, has understood that if you're, I was going to say, if you're a great civilization, if you're any civilization, if you're any culture, if you're any nation, if you're any people, to use these terms, there are things to apologize for. That's part of what being a serious person is. So the unapologetic thing is so appallingly childish. It really is at the level of a five-year-old. I'm not going to say, I'm sorry, I didn't do anything wrong. We know, really? That is that now our principle? The greatest American presidents, the greatest American authors understood, Lincoln, second inaugural. I mean, there are things that we very much did wrong and things we have to apologize for. And that's what makes us, to the degree we are great, honestly, makes us great. The nations that think they have anything to apologize for are the worst nations or the worst governments of nations, if you want to put it that way.
And do you think Putin thinks he has anything to apologize for? Mark Caputo said that they want this fight. And so I want to come back to that in a second. But first, I just want to listen to what some of the Democrats have said about this. Just kind of wrapping up Rubio first. He then went to Budapest, as mentioned. On the same day, so Orban gives a political speech. He has an election in 2 months, right? So Orban has an election in 2 months.
Yep.
It's maybe the most vulnerable he's been in a decade or more.
Yep.
I just want to pull out a couple of things. I'm not going to play the audio of this because it's in Hungarian, so that wouldn't really do us any good. But translated, Orban said this in a political speech over the weekend. We must get used to the idea that those who love freedom should not fear the East, but Brussels. And people should turn their anxious eyes to Brussels. So simultaneously, Rubio is waxing poetic about, you know, the great Western European culture. Our best friends in Europe are talking about the threat from Brussels of liberal democratic countries. Here's what Rubio then says after he lands and they have a joint press conference together. I'm going to be very blunt with you. The prime minister, Orban, and the president have a very, very close personal relationship and working relationship. I can say to you with confidence that President Trump is deeply committed to your success. So 2 months before the election, Rubio lands there and says Trump wants you to win, basically, and is very committed to your victory politically. This is obviously a right-wing autocrat.
I don't know how to translate that anyway other than a direct affront onto our traditional allies while he kind of pays lip service to, you know, this cultural connection.
Well, and a direct attempt to prop up Orban, who is in trouble, has been in trouble. I think there also were financial commitments made that will help him spend more, go further into debt, even though the EU's been trying to check that. So Trump will, in effect, backstop him because your success is our success, he said to Orban. So there are actually brave people in Hungary fighting Orban. There's a candidate running against him. There are liberals. I've met some of them, liberals in the old-fashioned sense of people who believe in a free country who have been fighting the good fight there with many disadvantages because Orban controls, because everything that's been happening here has been happening in spades in Hungary, and Orban controls the media and he controls access to capital and to resources. And but there are people trying to fight back, and Rubio goes there and steps on those people. I mean, it's much worse even than just saying something nice about Orban in some out of context. He's 2 months before the election, as you point out. He goes and weighs in against the dissidents in Hungary who are doing their best to restore Hungary to a free country, really, and to an ally of other free countries.
Yeah, Peter Magyar is the main opposition candidate.
Right, but there's a big, in there, you know, so Orban hasn't succeeded in stamping out all opposition. So there are sort of opposition structures, although they're weaker in Budapest. And so it's just disgusting what Rubio is doing. In that respect, Rubio is worse than the ones who just say it up front that that's, you know what I mean? That he pretends to be this spokesman for Western and even sort of liberal values, you might say.
Yeah.
And then he goes and helps Orban and hurts those trying to fight back against him. Really terrible.
Magyar is the president of the Respect and Freedom Party. Like, if Rubio was not being a shill for Donald Trump, it's a very Rubio-esque party. It's not some liberal, lefty, socialist.
Right. No. The reason he's a strong opponent, to, as I understand it, to Orban, is that he's sort of a center-right-ish, you know, pro-freedom person, right?
I mean, it's somebody that would have been in the tradition of what Marco argued for up until 2 minutes ago, is trying to help a country that is being, or a lot of freedom and rights are being stamped out by the current quasi-authoritarian government.
One more word on this. You had that thing. I hadn't heard the thing about the EUF that he said over the weekend, that Brussels is the threat. The threat comes from the West, not from the East.
Yeah, the threat, we should not fear the East.
Who is
Russia,
the East? The East is Putin. I mean, literally to the East, but also that's how Putin describes himself so often, and his theorists describe himself. So Orban says we should fear the EU because they have too many regulations on something or other, I suppose, more than Putin. Who has launched this brutal war in Ukraine, among many, many, many other things. And Rubio shows up 1 or 2 days later and says, we're with you. It's terrible. It's just terrible. And that's our Secretary of State. And that's the one in the administration who's supposed to be kind of the better one. Yeah, the one who's kind of quietly gonna save us from some of the worst aspects of Trumpism. He's legitimating the worst aspects of Trumpism.
He is. In the same speech, in case the East was not clear enough, basing these translations on Euronews and like European news wire outlets. But in the same section of the speech, he calls it Putining. Putining is primitive and frivolous. And so for me, I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe he's also criticizing Putin. But no, that's a critique of the Western practice of framing Russia and Putin as the scary threat. Like, that is frivolous, you know, to be overly concerned about Putin, because the tangible and direct threat is Brussels. Total madness and insanity. And that's what Marco has said, that's who we sidled up to. It's very important to Donald Trump that person succeeds.
All right, quick quiz for the hiring managers out there. What's worse, being understaffed or being poorly staffed? Well, that's a trick question, because both are recipes for chaos. Either way, just say to yourself, this is a job for Indeed-sponsored jobs. You'll get matched with candidates that meet the skills, certifications, and everything else you're looking for. Or go a different way and get no traction. Seriously, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. It really is a no-brainer. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs.
Struggling to see up close? Make it visible with Viz. Viz is a once daily prescription eye drop to treat blurry near vision for up to 10 hours. The most common side effects that may be experienced while using Viz include eye irritation, temporary dim or dark vision, headaches, and eye redness. Talk to an eye doctor to learn if Viz is right for you. Learn more at Viz.com.
Let's go to what some of the Democrats said about all of this. I'm just going to read from Mark Kelly and then play some AOC. Mark Kelly wrote this: when Secretary Rubio said the old world order was dead, he was right. It's dead because Donald Trump blew it up. He thinks this somehow benefits us. He is wrong. Our allies no longer trust us. It was obvious in the more than a dozen meetings I had with presidents, prime ministers, defense and foreign ministers. If you're Denmark and Greenland, a loss of trust is generous. China is now more popular in Denmark than the United States. This means these countries are looking elsewhere for trade and security. That's making us poorer and less safe. I want to play Mark Kelly and AOC, kind of give you a sense of how the various factions of the Democrats are talking about this. But do you have anything on Kelly?
I thought Kelly was very good, actually. Yeah, he's been very impressive for the last few months. I mean, maybe he's been impressive for longer than that. I wasn't following him as closely, but ever since the Hegseth attack on him, I've been following him more closely. And I mean, he said it well, and he's absolutely right about it. This thing didn't just blow itself up, this order that we've had for the last 80 years. It's been blown up by Trump, and Rubio's there justifying it.
AOC was over there. This caused a lot of stir. I think it's interesting to listen to her, to actually listen to her. And I'll have some thoughts on the back.
We have to have a working class centered politics if we are going to succeed, and also if we are going to stave off the scourges of authoritarianism. This is a moment where we are seeing our presidential administration tear apart the transatlantic partnership, rip up every democratic norm, and, you know, really calling into question, as was mentioned by David Carney at the World Economic Forum, the rules-based order that we have, or question mark, do we have? And we are in a new era, domestically and globally. There have been many leaders who've said we will go back. And I think we have to recognize that we are in a new day and in a new time. But that does not mean that the majority of Americans are ready to walk away from a rules-based order.
What'd you make about AOC?
So she's impressive, you know. What do you think, Kelly AOC in 2028? I mean, maybe you want AOC Kelly, let's be honest, you know?
No, don't try to put me in a box, Bill Kristol. Here's what I thought was interesting about it. Well, I wanted to play it. Because she expands on kind of both of the points that she makes several times. But like on the one hand, she's talking about the working class politics. It's like more of a domestic, you know, speaking to kind of her domestic base, really, but also sort of framing that as like also a way to fight authoritarianism, right? Whereas if working people feel like they're that the left party, what liberal party is more on their side, then they might be less susceptible to the authoritarian advances. And I think there's something to be said for it. And she also, though, talks several times with the democratic norms. And I think it's funny because if you just consume the kind of internecine lefty debate online, like a lot of times it gets framed up as like the Bernie left, you know, care about working people and economics, and the squishy centrists care too much about democracy and norms, right? And that hurt Kamala, that she cared too much about that. And so it's interesting to see here AOC like just do both, right? And do both, you know, off the cuff, right? And she seemed very comfortable talking about democratic norms. And it's the type of thing I think that a lot of like the lefty fans would like sometimes roll their eyes when other folks do it. And so I thought that was interesting. I also thought it was interesting that like at this point, like the DSA candidates are basically more committed to maintaining the rules-based order, the alliances, the economic and political alliances that we have with Europe than the former neocons are. I think that's a pretty interesting contrast as well.
Yeah, no, it's pretty amazing. I mean, has there been any pushback against AOC from the left? I mean,
I haven't seen it, but maybe, I don't know.
She's so invulnerable, maybe, right? Yeah. That she gets to say what maybe lesser social Democrats or democratic socialists couldn't quite get away with saying, but yeah, defending NATO. I mean, but I would say, you know, it's interesting as I listened to her. So in the early part of the Cold War, there were many social Democrats or democratic socialists and people who literally were from the socialist parties of their countries who were great allies in the fight against Soviet communism and who had been allies in the fight against fascism. And then there were the more, let's call them centrist, free market-ish, you know, types who we were more comfortable usually having as allies in Europe. And but there were big coalitions to often to fight against dictatorship and tyranny and oppression. I don't know if AOC is consciously sort of hearkening back to that, or whether she just, because Trump is destroying the rules-based order and because she does have a sense that this is really bad for the country and for the world, the effect of what she's saying is to begin to put together a genuine alliance, I would say, of a kind of working class oriented politics with a kind of liberal internationalism, which is good. And you don't have to buy every aspect of the working class oriented politics in terms of domestic economic policy to think that for the point of view of the country and the world, you need to have that broad alliance. We needed it in the 50s and 60s. We needed it through the Cold War. And we need it today, I think. Don't you think?
Yeah, I do. She called it class-based internationalism in a different clip, which I don't really know if that's real or what that is exactly. That's a little thin. But that notion, right, I don't think is wrong. If somebody could merge or fuse, right, a idea that the party is going to harken back to its roots and focusing on helping working people, all of the policies underneath that I probably won't agree with, but just at least aesthetically, and if the focus is put on that, I think that's probably right. And I think that probably would help in some ways, or at least would be worth trying in offsetting authoritarianism. I mean, the one thing that is true, if you're just analyzing the world, you know, comparative politics style, is like the left-wing parties everywhere have gotten to, you know, siloed among college-educated urban elites, you know, and there needs to be some type of effort to change that. Like, there are ways to go about that. AOC is offering one possible way that I think it's worth trying. So, you know, to me, it's like, okay, well, if you're going to try that and, you know, continue to, you know, have an internationalist commitment to allied countries and to countries that have, you know, commitments to fundamental small L liberal values, we could do worse than that. We're doing significantly worse than that right now. So anyway, my last thing I would just say about AOC, just as doing my version of Politico's figure skating judging, as people start to buzz about her 2028, watching the whole speech, she seems a little less sure-footed talking about all this stuff. And so I think it was good that she went there. She would not be the first candidate to enter a campaign for president and feel less comfortable talking about international issues. George W. Bush comes to mind as one. Many others, even Mitt, I think, got a lot better on that in his second campaign than his first campaign. Just thinking about people that I was following more closely, I think that if she does have her sights on that, it would probably be valuable to get more reps in on that sort of stuff. I couldn't tell. I listened to it very closely several times. I think she might have got Mark Carney's name wrong. I'm not 100% sure because she kind of mumbles it, which is sort of what I do. I see a parent from school and I forget their name. I kind of mumble it really fast. So it might have just been that. I don't know. Maybe I'm overstating.
But just not at AOC. I think it's impressive that she went there. And I've been there. I mean, there's quite a lot of pressure. I mean, everyone else, Friedrich Merz has spoken and the vice and Rubio, and she's on a panel. Right. And it's not as if she's reading a text, incidentally, I believe, right? So I give her credit for doing it, and probably can have people like us say, well, she wasn't perfect on this or that. But if you're running for president, if you're running for president or want to be a major figure, even if you don't quite run for president, this is the kind of thing you do. And but it's only February 26th. It's impressive that she's doing it this early. I kind of think she maybe is thinking seriously about running for president, though, don't you think?
I think so. I have no inside knowledge.
No, nor I. I'm just, you know,
if there was somebody in age between her and Bernie in her lane, I would think that maybe she would think the right thing to do is primary Schumer, right? Because I think that Schumer is extremely vulnerable and, you know, she's in New York and there isn't really. So I have to imagine she's thinking about it.
All right, quick quiz for the hiring managers out there. What's worse, being understaffed or being poorly staffed? Well, that's a trick question because both are recipes for chaos. Either way, just say to yourself, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. You'll get matched with candidates that meet the skills, certifications, and everything else you're looking for. Or go a different way and get no traction. Seriously, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. It really is a no-brainer. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs.
Struggling to see up close? Make it visible with Viz. Viz is a once daily prescription eye drop to treat blurry near vision for up to 10 hours. The most common side effects that may be experienced while using Viz include eye irritation, temporary dim or dark vision, headaches, and eye redness. Talk to an eye doctor to learn if Viz is right for you. Learn more at Viz.com.
Lastly, Caputo, our former colleague, said that in response, I forget who it was to, but in response to some of the pushback to Rubio on the left, he said basically, Rubio and Vance want this fight. Like, they want the contrast that was just laid out of AOC talking about, you know, internationalism and, you know, there are areas where we need to improve our commitment to human rights versus, you know, kind of a Western culture, unapologetic, tough guy, Americanism. I don't know that that's the kind of thing that actually defines an election or really matters. And it's hard to kind of to look out to 2028 and think how salient that may or may not be. But I do wonder if you think that the Democrats just should be a little bit worried about that, that just because the Rubio framing is obviously ridiculous, that doesn't mean that it's not necessarily effective. What do you think? What would you say to that?
I mean, a certain kind of nativism and unapologetic-ism, never apologize for anything that your country's ever done. I suppose that, of course, there's some appeal, demagogic appeal there, and the Democrats need to think about how to respond. Kelly is effective because he says it's making us less safe. If the actual truth of Rubio's talk is that his administration is betraying Ukraine, there's not popular support for that in the United States, right? So I think the Democrats need to frame it in a way to say this talk may sound vaguely nice to you, but we're for our allies because that's kept us safe and it's made the world more prosperous. We're for Ukraine because they're fighting bravely against Putin. And here's a little bit about how horrible Putin is. And here's a little bit about how Ukraine is fighting our fight for us and not asking for troops, just for aid. I mean, I think there are ways to do it that would be effective and not fall into some trap. Yeah, if you sound like some super goopy internationalist, yeah. You know, if only let the UN govern us, that would be good, I guess. But I don't think Democrats are pretty far from that these days. And look, I think the AOC thing, I hadn't really focused on it until you brought it up today. It's very interesting. If that really begins a move by even the AOC wing of the party into a more liberal internationalist foreign policy, as opposed to where democratic socialists really have been going the last 10, 20, 30 years, which was a repudiation even of that because it led to first to Vietnam and then to Iraq and so forth. They can still repudiate Vietnam and Iraq, or obviously.
But, yeah, sure. But more of an isolationist.
Yeah, but if it leads them away from a kind of isolationism or just wishfulness and into a healthier version of a liberal internationalist foreign policy, that's good for them and it's good for the country, I think.
Yeah. Also, this is, I'll be Bill Kristol-ish. Events are going to matter. You know, depending on how big of a shit show things are by the end of 2027, you know, I think there can be a compelling argument about how much weaker America is right now. And it's a little bit of an academic argument right now that China is strengthening and we are weakening in the world stage. And, you know, there's not a lot of tangible evidence for that unless you're the type of person that's like really paying attention to, you know, trade agreements and such. But if some tangible evidence of that develops, you know, I think that there might be a way to thread that needle. One other foreign policy thing that just caught my eye, I just kind of want to mention this because it could end up becoming a pretty important as we go forward on the AI beat. The Anthropic products are used in the Venezuela raid, which I thought was interesting. More interesting, though, was this story I saw this morning, which is that Pete Hegseth is saying that he's close to cutting all ties with Anthropic and designating the AI company a supply chain risk, meaning that anyone who wants to do business with the U.S. has to cut ties with the company. The reason why is that the CEO of Anthropic, Dario Amodei, says he wants to ensure that tools aren't used to spy on Americans en masse or develop weapons that fire with no human involvement. Pentagon officials are insisting that any relationship with AI companies allows the military to do whatever they want, basically. Anthropic, of the AI companies, they're the ones that are trying to focus on, you know, safety and like ethical considerations. And they are, you know, paying lip service to that, at least much more than their competitors. You know, kind of, we'll see, the proof will be in the pudding on all that. But I think it's pretty concerning and telling that our government is about to, is considering at least, declaring like full out war on the one AI company that is at least pretending like they care about safeguards. And, you know, we'll see how it all plays out. But I definitely think this is something to keep monitoring.
And how much is this just a way of channeling more business to Musk, since he's one of the other three, right? AI players, it might all be just
about
that. No, it's terrible. And of course, the same week, isn't it that Hegseth's sort of making it harder, I guess, for members of the military to be, who are going to law school to become JAGs, to go to, you know, the 30 top law schools in the U.S., basically, because they're so woke.
Yeah, the military might not cover it if you go to a woke.
Right. No, apparently they really, and they're telling people to reapply to other places and so forth. And I think they've also cut back on some of the mid-career programs that I very much enjoyed when I taught a little bit at the Kennedy School in the 2000s and had wonderful, you know, the majors and lieutenant colonels there for their year instead of going to the war colleges. Had a very good influence on the other students, incidentally. The Texas, they want to throw all that away. But these poor guys, these 35-year-old majors or these 25-year-old, I suppose, JAG, you know, law students, in Hegseth's view, they're so pathetically vulnerable. They have so little idea of what they believe, of why they're joining the military, that they're going to go to Harvard or Princeton, which is where Hegseth went, incidentally, and get brainwashed by a bunch of professors. I don't think so, really. You know, that was not my experience.
MIT was also on the list. It feels like we should have members of the military who have certain technical expertise should be able to go to MIT, I think.
Think about what Hegseth's selling people in the military. You are not a serious enough person to go to a place where the predominant culture is presumably liberal, I guess, though, in fact, the military's, thank God, the last 20 years been treated so much better at these schools than obviously post-Vietnam and stuff. So there's been very few real problems for them. But anyway, you can't go there because you're going to, I don't know what, you know, you're just going to get, the wokeness is going to permeate into your brain in some mysterious way, and you're suddenly going to not be a good member of the military. It's so insulting. It's so insulting to these serious people who are trying to become lawyers and JAGs, or who are getting their mid-career year of education so they can then move up and become, you know, full-bird colonels or ultimately general officers. You do wonder how much damage it's all going to do. It's so stupid. You almost can't take it seriously, but I don't know. I mean, it's going to lead to more people leaving the military, I suppose, who thought, you know, I'd like to go to a good law school if I'm going to go the JAG route.
I guess the best case for that policy is that Pete Hegseth is himself a graduate of Princeton and Harvard. So maybe they're not doing as good of a job as we think. On a few ICE things, I had never even covered this case, but it's worth mentioning it just because it's so striking. So the district court judge, Paul Magnuson, dismissed felony assault charges against two Venezuelans, Alfredo Ayorna and Julio Cesar Sosa Celis. This was in Minneapolis. They're accused of beating an ICE officer with a broom handle and a snow shovel on January 14th. The officer fired a shot from his handgun, striking Sosa Celis in his right thigh. So that was the whole story they told, basically, is that he shot him because they're beaten. They announced over the weekend that newly discovered evidence was, quote, materially inconsistent with the allegations. You don't say. Both officers have been immediately placed on administrative leave pending the completion of a thorough internal investigation. We'll see if those investigations actually occur. But I just think it's so notable, right? Like that we have these prime cases that everybody's debating. It's all in all of our faces where we watch them lie to us with their own eyes. But then there have been a lot of other instances of these guys like menacing people, injuring them, in this case, shooting them, and then lying about them and smearing them. So, I mean, it's good, I guess, that these things are being adjudicated, but it is a pretty notable state of affairs. Like, we literally just cannot trust anything that the Department of Homeland Security says.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the lies are just so, they're not like slight shading of the truth. They're exaggerating, you know, how much of trouble they were in, or the person hit them, but it really wasn't a shovel. It was just a broomstick. So it wasn't as serious. Yeah. It's not like that kind of thing. They just made up a story, right? I mean, it
sounds like it. Yeah.
To justify shooting someone. I am all out of patience with ICE and the Border Patrol in every respect.
All right. Quick quiz for the hiring managers out there. What's worse, being understaffed or being poorly staffed? Well, that's a trick question, because both are recipes for chaos. Either way, just say to yourself, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. You'll get matched with candidates that meet the skills, certifications, and everything else you're looking for. Or go a different way and get no traction. Seriously, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. It really is a no-brainer. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs.
Struggling to see up close? Make it visible with Viz. Viz is a once daily prescription eye drop to treat blurry near vision for up to 10 hours. The most common side effects that may be experienced while using Viz include eye irritation, temporary dim or dark vision, headaches, and eye redness. Talk to an eye doctor to learn if Viz is right for you. Learn more at Viz.com.
To that front, the DHS is currently shut down. There's kind of this partial government shutdown happening. We discussed this last week. Which part of the communists are you in? Which wing are you in? You're in the Trotskyite wing.
Leninist, Trotskyite. Yeah, yeah,
you're in the Trotskyite
militant,
wing,
yeah.
And somebody else is in. You're in the Trotskyite wing. You know, saying no, not a single penny for DHS. Shut it down. Negotiations are ongoing about whether maybe Republicans might change some of the various policies. Because we take good faith criticism here. We're not perfect. We're not unapologetic. There was a column that was unhappy with your hardline point of view. It's from Marcy Wheeler, who's been monitoring the Trump administration's successes for a long time now. So we'll take it. Basically, her argument was this: not funding DHS in this fight doesn't really do anything to change ICE and CBP's behavior because they have so much money. And so she says, to have that be the only ask is to basically throw up your hands in the hopes that in 11 months, Democrats will have the tools to do something more, all while letting ICE continue to spend billions unmolested. So the idea is basically, why not get some concessions now because they have enough funding anyway, and then refight the fight next year, essentially. What would you say to that dissent?
I mean, I'm for getting some concessions too. I didn't really think I was advocating totally dropping this. I do think the money is extremely important. $16 billion isn't that much given how much they got in the reconciliation bill last year, but it's not nothing. And Aaron Reichland, Melnick, and others say it, they'd let them draw down some of that other money. It means it's less available for the next couple of years. And also, I just think it lays the predicate for making the broader case against ICE and the Border Patrol if Democrats win the House and or the Senate, and then they really do need to get serious about the funding. So I think you need to get people used to the fact that the funding is as important as some of these concessions or adjustments in how they do business. I'm for going after all of them. I'm more than uncomfortable. I don't think it's a good idea to just swear off doing anything about funding. I mean, I respect Marcy Wheeler, and if maybe, look, this is a matter of tactics. Are Democrats going to vote? Let's say they get a couple of concessions on masks or on, body cam. They're not going to get masks, incidentally, but anyway, body cameras or something. Are they then going to vote to add funding? And again, not a small amount, $16 billion to ICE and to Border Patrol. I don't know. I would have a tough time after everything we've just talking about, the way they behaved in giving them a whole lot of money with pretty limited modifications in how they're doing business and no change in their leadership to speak of, right?
I don't see how you can without very real changes. And so this is kind of a devil in the details thing for me. But I don't know how you can give them another penny while they're masked, for starters. It's just no one else gets to be masked. We've seen the problems that it's caused already. It's a non-starter for me. I'm never going to be in the United States Senate, but that's where I would be. That'd be my message for them.
You haven't changed your mind about running? You haven't changed your mind about the Senate race?
I've not changed my mind.
Since we discussed it a week ago,
I have not. I think I'm worse. The more I reflect on it, the less competitive I seem. So I appreciate the feedback. Lastly, I would feel remiss if I didn't ask you. Former President Barack Obama was in an interview this weekend where he said he believes that aliens exist. He said he didn't have any evidence of that. He hasn't seen any evidence. And so I'm just curious where Bill Kristol is on aliens.
This shows my limited imagination, I'm sure, but I've never given it that much thought.
Not a lot of thought on aliens. What did Dan Quayle think about aliens, do you think?
Don't you think in Republican circles we were vaguely doubtful about aliens, I think.
Doubtful about
aliens.
I think
the people who were pro-alien.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an affront to religion, I think, if you're devoutly
religious. Yeah, so that's
religious.
True. It is an affront, and to at least to the biblical religion as we understand it. And also, the people who were pro seeing aliens, I guess there were elements. Was that a horseshoe thing? There were elements on the right and the left.
Yeah, probably horseshoe. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm still a little skeptical. I'm interested that Barack Obama is I only saw the sentences. So he said it's a very big universe. So why couldn't there be alien forms of alien life? I guess that's, if you define it broadly enough, that could be true. I don't know. I guess I'm old fashioned enough in that respect to think maybe kind of like the idea that we're the only actual human beings who have this ability to quite think and feel the way that we do. I don't know. Maybe that's just a prejudice.
I've kind of backtracked. I'm not even sure if we exist. Well, that's not, like, you know, this might all be fake.
That's a good position.
All I can know is that I exist. All right, Bill Kristol, thank you so much. I'll be seeing you in Minnesota. You're coming.
I'm certainly coming. I'm looking forward to it.
Sam Stein is with us. JBL and Sarah. We're going to have some special guests from the community. Very much looking forward to it. I'll be back for Mardi Gras episode tomorrow. Well, I'm just going to tell you now. It won't be with James Carville. We've done two James Carville Mardi Gras episodes in a row. And I had dinner with him about a week or two ago. And I was like, we're going to continue the tradition, right? And I'm not going to try to do his voice. But he was like, hey, I'm 81. I'm going on a cruise by myself. I was like, what? So you're going on a cruise by yourself? And he said, yes. I said, Mary didn't want to go. I've never been and I want to go. And so I was like, God bless him. That's great. I think good on him. Just think about like what a gift that is to whoever is sitting next to him at dinner.
I was thinking about that. You look up, you're on the cruise. They give you your table assignments and stuff. Yeah. And there you are. It's like, that would be something.
And it's James Carville. It's like people pay $25,000 a pop for this and you're going to get a full weekend of just unmolested James Carville material. So anyway, we'll have another good one. It'll be good. We'll have a Mardi Gras episode for you tomorrow. And then we'll see everybody in Minneapolis. Appreciate you, Bill. See everybody else tomorrow. Peace. Stupid man's been picking it with no need to rehearse. You got the East and the West Bank coming on the verse. London Crowd, day before Mardi Gras. It's like the new jazz order on your recorder on Lord Bill. The Bulwark Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.
Struggling to see up close? Make it visible with Viz. Viz is a once-daily prescription eye drop to treat blurry near vision for up to 10 hours. The most common side effects that may be experienced while using Viz include eye irritation, temporary dim or dark vision, headaches, and eye redness. Talk to an eye doctor to learn if Viz is right for you. Learn more at Viz.com.
May is Maytag Month, and Menards is passing the savings on to you. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with appliances in stock and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on Maytag appliances at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money.